Hello, I'm Martin Kessler, and you're listening to FlixWise Canada. Joining me today is the resident FlixWise artist, Emma Gerard. Hello, Emma.
Hi.
Thank you for joining me.
Thanks. I'm losing my voice. It's kind of a side effect of being a wayward woman, but...
That might be perfect, because there's not too much talking in the films we're going to be looking at today. It's a pair of silent films directed by G.W. Pabst and starring Louise Brooks, Pandora's Box and Diary of a Lost Girl. And these films are sort of unusual in that they're Weimar Republic German films starring an American actress, among many other reasons why they're probably unusual, which I'm sure we'll get into. But what do you think of each film, Emma?
Well, I like both of the films. I can't really give a good capsule version of what it is that I like about them, because it's sort of a tension between things that are absolutely horrible and things that are absolutely delightful.
Right.
In all of them.
They're both pretty full of horrible things happening to the main character. Like, there's death, there's child death, there's forced adoptions, there's just like a general sort of lack of human warmth in a lot of these character interactions. But one, it's sort of more of a downfall. Pandora's Box, it's like watching this person's slow decline until eventually she's killed by a serial killer. And Diary of a Lost Girl, it's a little bit more like, not that she's completely well off by the end, but at least she makes it through. And it's maybe, I think, a little bit more moralizing in its point. Diary of a Lost Girl, it sort of ends with this, oh, if there was more love in the world, it would be a better place kind of message.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't know how much of that was like Pabst partly responding to a lot of the negative reaction from Pandora's Box, because people did sort of accuse it of being too immoral. And I heard he had filmed maybe two different endings for Diary of a Lost Girl, and one was maybe meant to be more of that kind of moralizing ending, so I assume that's what we're watching. That one has like a little bit of a messier history, I guess, in terms of making it to today.
Uh-huh.
And even during the shooting, like I think Pabst was also sort of in pre-production on his first sound film at the same time, and maybe even in post-production of his Leni Riefenstahl mountain climbing film.
Oh,
so like I think he was kind of a little bit more all over the place with that one.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of looks a little bit more all over the place. I think, like, that they said the editing was a bit rushed for Diary of a Lost Girl, but it's unusual, I think, is the takeaway. Do you like one more than the other?
I think I do like Pandora's Box more than Diary of a Lost Girl. And
I think
it is pretty safe to say that Diary of a Lost Girl is the more moralizing one. Even though it does kind of have the less punishing ending, but I don't necessarily think that reflects on like the overall tone of the movie.
No, it feels a little bit like I know Pabst, he was part of that new objectivist movement, and I think he was really sort of interested more in like psychology, social psychology, individual psychology, especially related to sexuality. So like, I think just the idea of moralizing wasn't on his radar. So I think for people to have that kind of response to Pandora's Box maybe felt a little bit like, okay, fine, here's a thing. Like it kind of has the same sort of moralizing ending you might expect to see in a Chaplin film. Like that sounds like a Chaplin line saying, oh, if there's more love in the world.
There's more love in the world.
If only.
It might be. It's kind of weird, because in the context of like Weimar era art and film, though, like maybe it's not that moralizing. Like sort of the like hallmark of films of this time, like coming out of Germany, is just like this extreme sort of like anti-social impulse. Like there aren't a lot of scenes in either of these movies that look like a George Gross, you know, drawing, where it's just like, you know, like ginormous guys in top hats and monocles like falling over each other and like drooling all over the place. Like there aren't there, and there is murder in them, but it isn't like that sort of like fascination with like the sort of like psychotic murders or like the
right.
like what were they called, like Lustmord, I think was even like sort of a phrase that was applied to like in newspapers and even in paintings, like scenes of like just senseless murders of women was like a common motif.
Like it's sort of interesting, I watched this pretty close to the early sound version of Berlin Alexanderplatz, the 1931 version, and that's visually there's some similarities, but there's a little bit more of that kind of, I guess you could say, like grotesqueness, or like I think even just in general when you come to Pabst films, like when you're getting into silent films, it's a lot easier to gravitate immediately towards the sort of more visually striking expressionist movies, like you know, right away you're like, wow, Metropolis, wow, The Last Laugh, wow, Caligari, you know, that's the kind of stuff that really grabs your attention immediately. And I think it took me like a little bit longer to kind of figure out what's Pabst's deal, what are you doing that kind of makes these films interesting, because like it's not necessarily the visual style, like it's not
like these realist aren't either.
No they're definitely not expressionist, but like he still does stuff like I think like when he puts the filter over the lens, it's probably like a nylon stocking to give Louise Brooks this glittering in her eyes and her teeth with the light. Like, you know, it's not realism that he's going for either. Like, I think he's going for, I guess, more of a nuanced psychological effect, even though it's a little bit heightened at the same time, I guess. That's the impression I had.
Yeah, it's almost like closer to modernist cinema. It's like he's more interested in the way that actors can play like straight to a camera, and just sort of like the way that intimacy in film, like as a medium, I think can reflect more subtle performances, which is probably a good reason that he wanted Louise Brooks over someone more famous.
Sure. I mean, the story was that Marlene Dietrich was in his office when he got the call that Louise Brooks would agree to do it, which I don't know how apocryphal that is, but like that kind of gives the feeling like it could have easily been Marlene Dietrich in these roles. Although like I think Louise Brooks' comment on that was, "Oh, it would have been a burlesque if it was her," and which like it's kind of interesting if you wanted to put this up against like the Blue Angel, just to kind of contrast. Because I know Pabst tried to get the rights to the Blue Angel, and you could sort of imagine that maybe done in the style, it would have been a completely different film. But like Louise Brooks, I know like a lot of the criticism of her initially was that, oh, she's not acting, she's just kind of there. And I think the more you look at the film, one reason why they have both held up as well as they have, I think especially Pandora's Box, is, you know, she's definitely there, and it's just really subtle. It's not that kind of big sort of performances you usually think of when people say silent movies. You think of the silent movie style acting that's very exaggerated, very performative, and she's doing something that, you know, it looks like, oh, they just like turned the sound off. Like, you know, she's just kind of reacting in a more authentic way. And I know perhaps like how he would direct her, you know, he's maybe the right director for her, because he would look for ways to maybe affect her mood or affect her like immediate like psychology. Like for the scene at the end of Pandora's Box, when she's kind of hit rock bottom and she's dressed in these rags, he took her real favorite dress and then ruined it and made her wear it for the scene.
And
which sounds horrible, but she said like, if he had just costumed me with some rags out of the costume department, it wouldn't have really made a difference. But the fact that it was my favorite dress, you know, for her, it made that kind of real. She felt bad wearing that. So like the idea that things like that would come through in her performance on screen, I think like that's what he was going for, is something more authentic than just the sort of grand gestures you're used to seeing in silent films.
Oh man, so he was like doing like Kubrick and like torturing his actors before that was a thing.
I don't know if he was torturing. I mean, from what I understand, agreed to it, but it was like a little bit of a embarrassment. I mean, like things like that. I know, like the actress who plays the lesbian who's interested in Louise Brooks' character in the Louise Brooks biography by Paris, like, there's this whole section describing how this Belgian actress, she was completely shocked when she found out she was supposed to be playing a lesbian and she didn't want to do it and she didn't like Louise Brooks. So, like, Pabst said, well, just look at me during those scenes. Like, when he's dancing, or when they're dancing together, she's looking at Pabst and she's making this, like, very adoring face in the close-ups, and it cuts to the wide and she's looking... not very friendly, and he tried to edit it in a way to make this character look like somebody who's maybe closeted, frustrated, and kind of try to develop some depth for the character just through the editing and through her reactions. But I think he did try a lot of things like that, and that's kind of why he had the reputation of a director as he had, because he's not like a huge visual stylist, really.
Yeah. I saw, like, part of an interview with someone who was, I guess, an assistant of his during the movie, and he said, like, they would shoot a lot of the actor who's playing, you know, the guy who owns the theater, and he was had, like, a very, like, expressive, like, stage style, and they cut a lot of it because he also didn't want it detracting away from Louise Brooks's performance. Like, the movie is very much structured around showing off her and what she does. Yeah.
How effective do you find her performance? Like, what was your reaction to it when you watched these films?
I mean, it wasn't my first time seeing Pandora's Box. So, I mean, it's like, I don't know. It's kind of hard to get over thinking of her as, like, sort of that sort of silent film icon, and just sort of, like, from her, you know, appearance, which I think is a lot of what's lasted for a lot of silent stars. Like, I mean, we don't even have a print of, like, Cleopatra, but...
Yeah, with Theodora. Yeah. It's iconography, it's still around. And, like, Louise Brooks, that's definitely... She has that, like, Art Deco image, almost, you know, like, she was just fit into that era that, like, I think... part of the kind of cult following that developed around her, it's like purely just through her sense of style, her sort of aesthetic appearance, more than maybe as a performer.
But she does seem kind of throughout, like, even beyond, like, these movies, like, I checked out a few other things that she had been in, and it's like she is always sort of playing a, like, very sweet girl who wants to get along with everybody and is about ready to break out into dance at any moment, if that's what if that's what strikes her fancy. You know what? I'm gonna take that back, though. Like, she does have, like, I think especially in Diary of a Lost Girl, she has a lot more, like, sort of dramatic depth. I think, like, especially the portion of the film where she's stuck in that reformatory.
Oh my god, that's my, like, favorite part. Yeah,
that part is crazy. Like, it's, like, it's so oscillating good. So quickly between, like, terrifying and hilarious in, like, every scene. And that the bald guy, like, that was a performance.
I like, I think she said, like, it was in one of the biographies I was looking through that, oh, he looks like Nosferatu's brother. I don't, and the actress who played the sort of, I don't know, headmistress of the reformatory with the crucifix, where she's just getting, like, aroused while they're exercising. She's really fantastic. She, like, I think she was, she had, like, a background in, like, cabaret, and she does more, she had more, like, theatrical kind of comic or avant-garde type performances. And then she's also in a Threepenny Opera. And then I think, like, later on, she ended up in, like, a lot of new German cinema. Like, she worked with Schlondorf and Fassbinder. And I think she was even supposed to be in Herzog's Nosferatu remake. And then she died, unfortunately.
Oh, I see. But... she's credited as the director's wife.
Okay.
That character doesn't even have a name. It seems, like, pretty important.
I was thinking of her as, like, the headmistress, but, yeah, like, I don't even know if that's, like, the right
I thought
term
she was
for
in
it,
charge.
I thought so. That's the impression I get while watching it. But
it's nice to know she's married to the other guy. I thought it was just sort of, like, some sort of, like, homophobia that Pabst was sort of expressing. Because, you know, like, these are maybe not the kindest, like, depictions of lesbians in these two movies.
No, no. Although, like, one thing I kind of like is just... the character that Louise Brooks plays in both films, like, she just elicits this sort of insane sexual responses from people of both genders. Mm-hmm. It's just like they try and punish her for it, or they like, you know, I mean, it ends up killing her in Pandora's box, but she's completely sort of passive to it. Like, she's not trying to like manipulate people. It's just like they go insane out of desire for her. Like, you have the father and son competing for her attention in Pandora's box, which I thought it was funny, like, that was considered too racy for French audiences at the time, so they redid the intertitle so that it, instead of father and son, it was instead of a son, it was like the secretary.
Oh, wow.
But then, like, all the, like, hands on the shoulders and stuff, French audiences just assumed that they were a gay couple. So I don't know how much that changed it. But, you know, even though there's, like, a sexuality to the character, she seems, like, very sort of innocent of people's responses to her, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of, like, the interesting way that she's used in this movie, or in these two movies, and even in other movies she's been in. It's, like, she's supposed to be, like, sexy and like open about her sexuality, but at the same time she's very infantilized, and it's right. Like kind of creepy.
No, like when she's like swinging from the guy's arm, you know, and she's, you know, it's very sort of childlike, a lot of her, and the character, I think it's supposed to be like younger than she is. Like, I think she mentioned the character is supposed to go from like 16 to 18 or something. Yeah. Like that, like, it's,
and she's supposed to be having to be young. Her first communion in Diary of a Lost Girl, which
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's meant to be like a teenager, so yeah. I don't, both of these, they kind of reminded me of like some of Marquis de Sade's stories, like the Justine or the Misfortunes of Virtue, and Juliet and the Prosperity of Vice, like those kinds uh-huh. of stories where it's just like the string of horrible mishaps and sexual predators on these sort of innocent character, and then she ends up getting killed. Like, it has that kind of a quality to it. And I don't, like, that there is sort of like an underlying sadism, I find, to like a lot of the situations the character finds herself in.
Oh, completely. Yeah.
But I don't know, do you have any other favorite performances or
in these? Is there anyone else? Well, I think also in Diary of a Lost Girl, since we're on the topic of like people who can't control themselves around her, the guy who takes dancing lessons from her.
Oh, with the beard.
Guy,
yeah,
that guy was hilarious.
There's a few like comic touches, like, you know, as like frightening as these films can be, there's like little funny moments, like when one of the guys is trying to look through the crowd and he kind of gets like a feather fan in the face, or there's a moment that made me laugh in Pandora's Box when they there's like that one guy before they have the review, the stage performance, and he kind of gets the powder in the face, and he's just doing this weird little like mouth movement that's really funny. So it's like a weird injection of humor into some of these.
Yeah, well, that
movies,
whole sequence,
but
in Pandora's Box is, like, great. Like, that's a good breakup between, like, all the, like, you know, infanticide and stuff that's gonna happen. Like, yeah. Have, like, a little, like, you know, stage people sequence. And it's got all, like, the good, like, stage people, like, tropes. Like you're trying to talk to somebody, you get cut off by a piece of scenery getting marched by. Yeah.
And there's the couple that kind of keeps going back out for the applause. Like, mm-hmm. I think they go back more than once. But something about, like, the mixture between, like, the fairy tale aspects and just some of these people with strange faces, that, you know, it kind of made me think almost, like, of the structure of a fairy tale. Like, in Pandora's Box, like, this whole quality of, like, she's going on the run, and she's got, like, you know, the couple of guys following her, and, you know, the older ones almost, like, troll-like. It made me think of, like, Snow White somehow.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
And then at the end, the serial killer, like, he's, like, the Prince Charming, except instead of kissing her, he's come to murder her. Like, it has that kind of, like, dark, amoral fairy tale quality that I find that appealing somehow.
Yeah, that ending is, it's something. It's like he was the murderer, and now he's reformed, and then he might be coming to murder her, and then she's like, oh, but you seem like a nice guy, and then he does murder her after all. It's like, I don't know. It's sort of, you're right, it's like a mixture of the Big Bad Wolf and the Prince Charming in reverse, and also, you know, like, it's not like a straight irony. Like, you think he's this, but he isn't this. It's like, he is, and then he isn't, and then he is again.
And just, like, the casting of the actor, like, it's not somebody who you immediately, I think even today, like, if you're trying to cast, like, oh, that's the serial killer character, you wouldn't think of that guy, Gustav Diesel. Like, he's sort of like handsome looking guy, charming. And I almost thought like not quite, but like a little bit of like Anthony Perkins in Psycho. Like when Janet Leigh first meets him and he's sort of not entirely charmless, you know?
Yeah.
Or like you don't, he's not trying to act threatening, which kind of makes it sort of creepy and more interesting than if it was just sort of like an obvious, I don't know, lunatic out in the loose, I guess.
This does predate that 1930s Sweeney Todd, which I think is where a lot of like that sort mm-hmm. of actor's archetype for the serial killer came from. Todd Slaughter, I think his performance is like the origin of the movie Psycho.
Right. Yeah. Well, because I think it was just happening right when these films were made, the killer that M is sort of based on.
Uh-huh.
So it was like pretty fresh in people's minds when these films were being made. And like something about the environment of Weimar era Germany, like, you know, it's sort of famous, the kind of like sexual freedom, but like also the, you know, the criminal nature to it. Like that's partly, you know, when you have the hard shift to Nazism as the economy kind of stalled again, like a big part of that was like, oh, look how immoral all this is. And it was, you know, all this degenerate artwork, and they kind of lumped all of it together.
Yeah. But I think it was like a very like divided society at that point. Like, I think it's kind of clear, like even watching these movies, it's like not everyone was on board with like the cool, like open nightlife of, you know, Weimar Germany. So I think there
was. No, for sure.
Yeah.
And like just reading like a little bit more about Pabst, like the way he sort of describes himself as interrogating the social ills, like it kind of gives you the feeling that like he's probably not just, like he probably does see these things as maladies, not as like, oh, isn't that great how free and open they are? That like instead it's some sort of you know, social, psychological, sexual perversion. Like that's the kind of impression I have a little bit from what Pabst's intent was.
Mm-hmm.
Although, like again, like it does feel sort of distinct from other films that just like don't even address it, or you know, just completely gloss over character sexuality. And
I think that's like, it's interesting because there's like a lot of record of like what Louise Brooks thought about all of this, because she wrote books about it, and like she was sort of rediscovered and interviewed a lot at the end of her life. And I get the impression that like what's interesting about her to me is that I get the impression that she felt very aware that it was like she needed to use her appeal to men to make it in movies, and that was what was going to make her successful. And it's like she was not 100% okay with it. It was just like she mm-hmm. was willing to use it. So yeah, I'm not really sure where I'm going with that.
Well, like one thing that kind of makes her stand out, especially when you read about her biography and read about her experience in Hollywood, is she was sort of fearless in burning bridges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like she sort of seemed like somebody who kind of, you know, if she wasn't getting her way or felt like she was being exploited, she would leave. Like that's sort of how she ended up in Europe working on these films.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was sort of right when they were switching over to the sound era. And I guess at that time, Paramount was renegotiating the contracts for a lot of silent actors. They said, well, you know, either you can sign on for $500 a week or you're out of a job completely. And I think they said like she was the only actor who turned that down.
Yeah.
Because you know, why would she you know, I think like her desire to be a star, that's something that like a lot of, you know, happens even today, that people sort of exploit. And I think what sort of makes her interesting partly is that, you know, she was willing to just completely disregard that kind of like, oh, you want to be a star kid? Like, no, I'll go to Europe. And then when it doesn't work out in Europe, I'll go back to Hollywood. And then, you know, eventually her career stopped. But like, you know, it's hard to deny that she didn't leave this like huge impression on people and on film.
Yeah, I get the impression also that she just sort of like, she wasn't really forced out of Hollywood. I think she just kind of quit because she felt like they weren't going to make anything good, and she wasn't going to be in crap, like, which is kind of amazing.
Well, Well, like her last film, I was thinking like there's something really kind of strange and sad when you see the
I haven't
Overland
seen
Stage Riders.
it, but it's like the only one where she doesn't have her haircut, right?
Yeah, and like it's also one where she like actually leans into her Kansas accent.
Oh, cool.
And it's so clearly like the end of an era and the beginning of another, but the new era is not going to be quite as good, you know, because mm-hmm. Louise Brooks won't be in it. Like, there's almost like that kind of a feeling when you watch it, like, oh, here comes John Wayne, you know, goodbye.
Like, here comes so, John Wayne. And there goes Louise Brooks.
Swaggering up. Yeah, I mean, like, how bizarre is that there's, like, a scene where Louise Brooks is John Wayne's love interest? Like, that's not right. Like, and, like... You know, I think, like, she really does sort of, in some way, like, embody the end of that silent era. And even though she had sound films that came after, partly without her voice, but that feeling that, you know, she sort of represented a kind of aesthetic ideal or development that was reached that was cut short by the introduction of sound. And in some ways, the regression of the art form that, like, a lot of directors were sort of upset by with the introduction of sound that... Like, I think partly when you look at the iconography of Louise Brooks, like, part of it's her appearance, but it's also the fact that, like, I think she does kind of symbolize something of that height of the silent era, and the fact that these films come at the very end of it when all these techniques are sort of available to anyone, and like, you see the kind of stylistic development, you know, in some ways the performances and style of, you know, Pandora's Box, like, it feels more modern than a lot of the films that would follow with sound, you know, the movement of the camera, the style of the performance, you know, it's like
that awkward not necessarily to sound phase where everything is just like a bunch of people standing in a staticky sounding room.
Like, you know, she's just, it seems like she's so not suited for that. I mean also, like, I remember, like, after the first time I saw Pandora's Box, like, when I was fairly young, like, I assumed she must be European. Like, I did, you know, you watch the film and it's intertitles, and she's kind of, like, become a little bit synonymous with the Lulu character. Like, you know, her book was the Lulu in Hollywood, and she would sort of call herself Lulu. Like, she was the character. So, like, you know, for me for a while, it was, like, Lulu Brooks. And then, like, I finally heard her talk, and it came as, like, a little bit of a shock that, you know, she's American, and... But like, I you know, I like her in not just the way she speaks, but just like her voice, actually, like her insights into film, or the way she talks about the film history. Like, you know, it's actually really compelling, you know, that she would sort of be the most important critic of her own career.
Well, who else would be at that point? I mean, it's like astounding how little was just sort of preserved. I think a lot of like the actors that we do know from the silent era is partially because they did look after their own legacy. You know, like, we wouldn't even have Buster Keaton films if reels hadn't been sitting in his house that he'd had
in his garage. I heard, like, people would just go over and he'd be like, oh yeah, whatever, and he'd have the cigarette with the ashes dangling over, like, Prince of the General or something, like.
I mean, I think it's a little different with German films. I think the UAF did make preservation efforts, even if that meant that these films weren't seen in America for a very, very long time. I think that's true that they did.
No, yeah, I think that's right. Although, it's kind of funny, like, Diary of a Lost Girl and Pandora's Box, they're not UFA. Like, you get so used to seeing, like, the little UFA at the beginning of so many of these films, like, when you watch Lang, and then, like, you get this, like, weird little Nero film logo at the beginning. You're like, what is that? You know, it sort of almost sets you up for something a little bit different. And, like, it's kind of interesting. Like, it was such an international cast and group of people working the film, actually, because silent era, you could cast people from all over the world. Because, you know, you're acting in the sort of cinematic language. Like, you're not... It doesn't matter what language you speak. So, like,
yeah,
I think Paps, so, like, with the cast on Pandora's Box, he had to direct in English, French, German, and Czech. So he was talking to actors in four different languages, but, you know, that's kind of what you could do. And a little bit later, like, it was interesting, like, those early sound films when they didn't quite know like what to do for the international market yet, so you'd like
they just shoot
film
it
four
twice.
different scenes in different languages, or like they just didn't really like know how to handle that yet. But I don't know. I thought that was cool that Pabst was fluent in four languages. So
okay.
I think he's like Austrian, but he's kind of Czech, really, but not really.
If he'd spoken Spanish, he would have been perfect for Hollywood in the sound era, early sound era. Like,
I don't know why he didn't go over to Hollywood when so many of the other German filmmakers did. He had gone to New York, I think, before these Pandora's Box and Diary of a Lost Girl and some of his other films, I think, to do theater in like the, you know, like late 1910s, early 20s, and then gone back. And then, I don't know, he sort of stuck around, and he's like, I don't think he ever made propaganda films, but there's always been like a little bit of controversy about like his later career during Nazi Germany and during the war. Like, he kind of made sort of apolitical films, but like he was friends with Leni Riefenstahl, and like he didn't, you know, isn't totally squeaky clean.
Right.
You know, and he made like a couple films, I think, after the war. Like one of the more famous ones was Last 10 Days, which was about Hitler. And I think they say it's like one of the first films in Germany to treat Hitler as a character and have an actor play him. But it's still sort of a little bit shady, I guess, is how you would summarize that.
Interesting.
But I don't know, in some ways I think Pabst was kind of the perfect director for Louis Brooks, and Louis Brooks was the perfect actor for Pabst, and kind of their work on other sides of their career just like it doesn't quite work the way it should, you know. Like when you watch Louis Brooks, some of the American films are really good. Like I like William A. Wellman's Beggars of Life, which is kind of really similar to Pandora's Box in some ways. Like the whole scene where right at the beginning when the guy is trying to shoot her and then she ends up shooting him, like it's very similar to in Pandora's Box when the guy's like, oh, you have to kill yourself, and ends up getting shot instead. So it seems like some of that persona that she plays into in those films is already there. But
yeah, I was hoping we would bring this one up because... we could talk about how she is like, I feel like if it's like if somebody watched Pandora's Box or Diary of a Lost Girl and took the wrong thing away from it and then like wanted to make a movie with her, they're like, okay, so she's like a little girl, but like her stepdad is so out of control lusty for her that she has to like shoot him, and then she's disguised as a little boy for the rest of the movie, but like a sexy little boy.
Oh, Wellman, what have you done? And then, like, later in the film when they stick her in the bonnet and she looks, like, somehow wrong with that.
Yeah.
She has that hat on for, like, half the film. I'm like, take it off. It's horrible. It's a bad disguise and it looks weird. I don't know. I think that was before Pandora's Box. So, like, I wondered if...
Oh, okay.
If that was, like, part of why maybe Pabst wanted to cast her.
I think I heard he saw her in, I don't want to say the W.C. Fields one. Like,
oh, okay. Like one of those
it was
earlier
some
ones.
Movie where she was just like a woman in the background, like almost. So it was kind of surprising that.
I know it was like a big casting search because like the Lulu character, she was sort of big for German theater, German sort of literary figure, so like they were looking all over the world, they were looking for a lot of German actresses. I know there's like an older version of Pandora's Box from the early 20s.
Okay.
Where Asta Nielsen plays her.
Ooh.
And I know, right? You can see the I don't know if it's lost or if it's just not on YouTube, because for me those are kind of the same thing right now. If it was on YouTube I'd watch it, but
right.
And I know Pabst he made a film with Asta Nielsen, Joyless Street, I think. Yeah, I think it was Joyless Street. It's just sort of interesting that they played the part, and I kind of wish I had seen the older Pandora's Box just to be able to compare.
Yeah.
But like, I know in the biography, Louis Brooks said like Asta Nielsen's performance, she was much more of a man eater, which you know I can kind of imagine. Like she has like a much more assertive screen presence usually.
Yeah.
You don't dress her up like a boy, you dress her up like a man.
Exactly.
But I don't know, like, how do you sort of feel about these films kind of coming at the end of the silent era? Like, just maybe comparing them a little bit more to other silent films, or even just like Hollywood silent films.
Oh man, I can't, like, they really don't bring any Hollywood silent films to mind. Like, they do, I think thematically and sort of the way that they're about the darkness of society, like, they fit a lot more closer into, like, a German expressionist film, even though visually the style is completely different than an expressionist film. But yeah, other than that, it's like it's pretty straightforward German to me.
Very German. How do you think they hold up? Like,
Oh, they hold
are there
up
any
great.
aspects you
Like, they
still think are
still, like,
creepy? Or...
especially Pandora's Box, they still look
Yeah.
awesome. The visual style is a little different in Diary of a Lost Girl.
Yeah, it's not as shadowy, and I feel like Pandora's Box, a lot more of it's in close up.
Yeah, I think so. I wonder, wait, which one was actually made first? Was Pandora's Box?
Pandora's Box was made
Okay,
first.
yeah.
And then I think while Pandora's Box was wrapped up, Louise Brooks went back to America, where she had done the Canary Murder movie with
Okay.
William Powell
Yeah.
that was like being converted to sound. And I guess they offered her a bunch of money to convert it to sound, and she was like, no. So they dubbed over her with another actress, and they also like had her double in some scenes. There's like these weird shots where you see like just the profile of somebody talking, and it's supposed to be Louise Brooks.
Was wondering about
Yeah,
that.
that movie's it's kind of a messed up movie. But and then
Well,
I
she
guess
doesn't
like
make it past the first 20 minutes of the film anyway, so
no, it's
it
yeah, that movie's not great. I like William Powell, but no. And so I think like Louise Brooks after that was like, I'm going back to Europe. So she was cast in that film. I think it's just called like Miss Europe usually, or sometimes Beauty Prize, which was a French production, and they were like, oh, like we're still trying to get the money together. So she just had Time to Kill in Europe, so Pabst was kind of like, yeah, let's do another one. So I think like there was only 6 months between them, and then in those 6 months Pabst had already shot another film that was being wrapped up. So like, I don't know, they cranked them up fast actually.
Yeah.
They were really really making movies back then. But he did offer her other films, I think. Like, he kind of had this idea, like, he was going to mold her as an actress, almost like von Sternberg and Marlene Dietrich. Like, I think he wanted that kind of a relationship, it sounds like, with her. And she wasn't into that, so I think she was done.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, it's sort of weird. It sounds like a weird re working relationship, but, like, she always spoke very highly of him. But I think she sort of pointed out herself just the way she looks from one film to the next, like you can kind of tell, like that there's just a shift in how he sees her. But I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think that Pandora's Box, like, the visual style is like everything is shot a lot tighter, and there's like it's sort of built around her face almost like the entire movie. Whereas I think Diary of a Lost Girl is just sort of everything is
She's
just sort of
there, and
yeah.
there's a lot of other stuff happening.
Well, that's like what is part of what's so like intriguing and unappealing about these films at the same time. It's like it's a question to me of like how much of this, like, I like maybe Pabst is one of those filmmakers who just really puts themselves and their lives into their films without realizing it. And like, was this whole thing just sort of a project that was like him figuring out to himself how he felt about Louise Brooks? And sometimes that's what the film feels like. Like, we're like watching her under a lens and trying to figure out what's going on with her through this guy's like vision.
I mean, every character in the film, they're like obsessed with her in some way, and like, you know, whether they want to have sex with her or kill her, like it's a similar sort of obsession. You know, you can sort of
Yeah.
connect that maybe to, you know, how Pabst maybe felt about her. Like, I think that's a good point. You know, she's the main character, but she almost feels like the only character that you're not inside their head somehow. You know, and like on one hand, that is kind of, I don't know, makes you maybe think less of Pabst's motivation as an artist, or at least call it into question. But at the same time, like, it does make for such a interesting on-screen dynamic. Like, a part of me, you know, find it, like, really compelling in a way to just
I don't think that makes it any less of a film to think of it that way.
And, you know, that's usually not what gets talked about when you talk about, like, Louise Brooks in these films. Well, you know, what I always thought was, like, a little bit weird is you usually have a conversation about Pandora's Box, and it's like, oh, she looks so beautiful in the film. It's like, what about, like, all the other stuff? You know, like, it almost comes as an afterthought that there's, you know, murder and there's all these other things going on, you know?
Yeah.
It's sort of funny, the initial critical response where they accuse these films of being too melodramatic and just kind of senseless, which I don't know. It's, I mean, one thing I found really interesting just in reading more about her was the whole Denishaw modern dance kind of background. She was trained as a dancer, not as an actress. And, like, I didn't really know about it, but just reading this description of Denishaw dance as specifically not ballet and about finding sort of the emotional meaning in certain gestures, and, like, you can almost see that in a lot of her performance, I find, like, the sort of significance of a subtle gesture, how it maybe conveys emotion in this way that's almost more like a dancer than as an actress. And in some cases, she's literally dancing, but you can almost see that idea of how movement, the sort of effect that it has translated into just her facial expression.
Yeah, like, it's almost Alexander technique before that was, like, a thing.
I guess so. Like, it's not naturalism and it's not realism, but at the same time, it feels like such a strong rejection of the type of style that had come before it. And, like, it's that kind of thing that makes you feel like Silent Era was maybe cut a little bit short, this idea that it was still developing artistically and that there were still maybe movements to come further, you know, if it had developed longer, that it would just continue to develop as an art form and its performances and its visual styles without the introduction of sound, you know, that it wasn't something that was squeezed dry quite yet, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is there anything else you wanted to mention or talk about? Or
There was just, like, one little visual gag in Diary of a Lost Girl that I have to point out, okay. Which is when they're putting on lipstick, and, like,
oh,
and then she shows this sign that just says "Verboten," like, everything is verboten, and then this, like, bald head rises up. Like, I felt that was, like, that was some high cinema right there.
I like the one girl in the reformatory who looks like she's, like, at least, like, 38.
Yeah. Wait, and then she, obviously some time passes by. She starts her new life, and then she comes back as a, like, sponsor or, like, a patron of this reformatory, and she recognizes somebody being brought in. I don't know. I guess the point, well, like, the story is really not super important in these films.
No, there's actually, like, a surprising amount of plot for both of these films. Like, if you look on the Wikipedia, it was, like, a giant chunk of text because there's so much that happens, but it all kind of goes by so fast. I remember the first time I watched Pandora's Box, it felt like I just watched, like, a 3-hour long movie because, like, oh, they go away to England and there's the whole, like, gambling sequence and there's this and that, and, like, like, a lot happens, but really, like, you don't really remember much of the plot.
Yeah, there's a lot of plot, maybe not a lot of story, because perhaps the story takes place in, not in the world, but inside the human mind.
Beautiful. So, I don't know, if you want folks to find you on the internet, where can they look?
They can't.
If they want to see some of your lovely artwork, they should look at flixwise.com.
Yeah, absolutely.
I gotta come up with something. I don't know.
We do have, by the way, we do have some t-shirts. We don't have, like, all the ones we want. We have some.
Do we?
Yes.
I didn't know this. I want one.
See, you didn't even know that.
No. I'll have to look into this.
We've got the logo. You can get it in black and white. You can get it on a hoodie if you don't want it on a t-shirt. And we've got the witch. And
oh my god, that's awesome.
I got my drawing of Black Phillip on a tank top because that's how I wanted it. Yeah, there's options.
Well, I definitely want one of each, so I'm after this episode, I'm gonna have to figure that out.
I know. There'll be more. There'll be the stalker one eventually.
That's great. Thank you, Emma. And until next time, take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.